This is a lecture given by L. Ron Hubbard on the 16th of November, 1956. The title of this lecture is Summary Lecture. Copyright 1956 by L. Ron Hubbard in the United Kingdom. Copyright 1978 by L. Ron Hubbard in the USA. Copyright 1988 by L. Ron Hubbard Library. All rights reserved. Unauthorized duplication, translation, importation, and distribution is a violation of applicable laws. This tape is 57 minutes long. Reproduced by Golden Era Productions.
Okay. This is a lecture, which is a summary lecture on SLP 8, which is to say on processing culminations and so forth of a great deal of research. This SLP 8 is something that has been gotten together over a considerable period of time. It's been tested and retested and mauled around, and we have some certainty to believe that it is possessed of a certain power of cleavage with regard to cases. In fact, we would go so far as to say that if you can find a case that doesn't crack under this, we give you a brand new pair of snow tires and a television set. The snow tires with holes in them and a television set that spits nothing but gamma. Now, before looking over SLP 8, we have to have a considerable understanding of some very basic types of processes. We went into that yesterday. We went into it, looked it over very thoroughly on the of confrontingness, substitution, havingness, the places where these belonged, one relationship to the other. Now then, SLP 8 follows this basic set of rules, but is not at this moment in a finalized, exactly placed form. We have a series here of about 27 separate processes, each one of which is very destructive to cases. And going over these classes again, we find that the classes are havingness, which means he couldn't substitute for it, and he couldn't confront it, so he's got it. Got the idea? I mean, he couldn't substitute for it, and he couldn't confront it, so he's got it. We know that havingness, it was very incomprehensible for a very long time, by the way, why havingness did anything for anybody. You know, that's incomprehensible. A Thetan who is not a mass does not discover it very easy to confront a mass. Do you see? Why should he communicate with a mass? It is a mass and he's not a mass. Now, where's the communication? Tisn't. And therefore, why should havingness, why should getting more of this stuff that won't duplicate him and that he can't duplicate, do anything for him at all? And that was the problem. And the answer to that problem was a very simple thing, very, very simple. All it does is substitute in a total identification which is so identified that it doesn't even have a subject. You follow me? Total identification. Now look around this room and tell me something you could have. A fellow says, well, he says, let me see, I could have that scrap of paper on the floor. Maybe, at least I could have the dirt on it. Something on this order. Well, he has found the lowest order of substitute for something he knows not what. And he's very happy thereby. So he say, all right, now look around the room and find any more you could have. And he says, well, he says, I could have the shadow up there. All right, so that's fine. Why could he have the shadow? What's this whole thing about? It's the shadow is a substitute for something else. And he finds that he could confront the shadow rather than the other thing. So that people, when they run havingness, get a great many cognitions. Their awareness goes up like a shot. Why? Because by, quote, substituting for things they cannot confront, they come that much closer to confronting them, and the definition of awareness could be said to be simply this: awareness is a capability of confrontingness. That which one can confront is that of which one can be aware. And so we get havingness working. We're taking apart the overwhelmedness of the case. Now, the word, by the way, overwhelm is quite interesting. If you look at it very carefully, you'll find out there must have been a word called whelm. And you want your case in a state of being whelmed, not overwhelmed. You understand? Very, very elementary. But he's overwhelmed by the room, and then we find that he can find parts of the room and substitute, you know, but he doesn't even know what they're a substitute for, but they're a substitute for something. And he starts walking upstairs, and he gets from overwhelmed to whelmed. And if you get him up high enough above confrontingness, why, he can do some whelming himself and some overwhelming too, see. Now, all processes are run on a game's condition, which is to say, no effect on self, total effect on somebody else. That is a game's condition. Many parts to a game's condition, don't be confused. Very interesting ramifications in game's conditions. Tremendous importance should be attached to all these parts. Washington Briefing Bulletin of about the 25th of August, 1956, contains the list in full. I know nowhere else it appears. It's only a partial list in Fundamentals of Thought. Most important parts of that list: no effect on self, total effect on others, and enemy and identity. Those are the most important parts of the list from a processing standpoint. We take for granted the attention and intention and the rest of it up at the top. We take for granted in a game that communication is possible. Now, therefore, the significance that you run with somebody is to say, give me an enemy of comparable magnitude. Well, he found out that he could face his little terrier dog, but he couldn't face that space fleet back in 872 BC galactic times, GT. He couldn't face it, but he could face a dog. What's the dog got to do with the space fleet? God knows. In fact, I doubt God would know, to be frankly. Been through his records lately, terrible condition. Yeah, I was looking around one file called Earth. Boy, is it scrambled. Now, here we have, then, the lower orders of things in terms of cases. And all this presupposes that some awareness can be achieved by the preclear of the auditor. Because no awareness can be achieved to the auditor, why, that's that. No awareness at all existed, why, he's dead, as far as you're concerned. Chalk him off. Chalk him off, run him for president. You haven't any technique which takes a totally unaware person, and by the way, I get that phrasing carefully, totally unaware person, and puts him into a condition of awareness. You would have to wait for some impulse of awareness of something and then do something with that. Do you understand that? Now, it's not true that a person lying in a comatose state is totally unaware. A person is who is normally considered unconscious is recording like mad, as we knew from old Dianetic days. And also, weirdly enough, a person who is unconscious or a person who is 5 hours old alike will understand commands and execute them to the best of their ability. All right, then, SLP-8 with these provisos is, of course, highly usable. It's usable only because it brings a person up in terms of awareness. He becomes aware of the universe, he becomes aware of what he's doing, where he's going, becomes aware of his goals, and so on. So you might say offhand that your dedication here is to increasing awareness. A criminal can only be a criminal, by the way, if he's unaware of the pain and misery which he causes. politician can only yap around about war as long as he's totally unaware of the other nation. It takes a very ignorant, unaware sort of a person to engage in criminal, political standard type of political operation that you get in the mid-20th century. To engage in these activities, he has to be very unaware. Most of these people are in an obsessive game condition. They're high unknowing games condition, you see? They don't know what game they're playing, but they're certainly working like mad at it. They have no great awareness of the opponent and so on. They have no real awareness that they're playing a game. It's quite fascinating to assess their true state of case. They come as close to being unprocessable as anything you ever saw. You'd have to hog-tie them, jump up and down in front of them, mimic them in some fashion or another. I don't know, they're probably screamers, most of them. If you started to make very much motion in their vicinity or mimic them or something, they'd probably scream or roar with anger or something. So, this is, I'm not being snide, by the way. I just wish you to have a fairly decent appreciation. What would you think of somebody who would casually contemplate the murder of 10 or 15 million people? This man couldn't possibly be considered sane, and he couldn't possibly be considered aware. He couldn't consider himself at all. Do you see this? It's a problem in unawareness. His ethics, his morality, his capability of good, sound judgment alike depend upon his ability to be aware. Do you see that? Unless he is aware, unless he can achieve an awareness of his environment and so on, he is not able to achieve an ethical standard. Now, insanity is a highly specialized mechanism. It is not a mechanism which one suddenly descends into. It is an assumed mechanism like death. A very high-toned case can all of a sudden kick off the body. Similarly, a person can kick himself into insanity rather easily. Insanity says, even death would not avail me. But I am no further responsible and I should not further be punished. It is not a consequence of a great many actions. We can synthesize the feeling of insanity by can't reach, must reach, can't withdraw, must withdraw. And we get that same sensation. Sensation can turn on almost anywhere. It isn't something that is peculiar then to the tone scale. It'd actually be incorrect to mark some portion of the tone scale insane. You see, that is not a good rule of thumb. But it is a good rule of thumb to mark some portion of the tone scale with degrees of unawareness, and that is what the tone scale is. Follow me? Now, there are types of awareness which are rather interesting to observe. They're inverted awarenesses. The individual cannot be aware of anything right where he is, but can be aware of something at a distance. The reversion of that is he can't be aware of anything at a distance, but he can be aware of something right where he is. Point out a place where you are not gives us this at once. We start to run this technique just over and over, just old-time technique. And the individual at first finds stuff way out, another universe and all sorts of things. And then he starts coming in and eventually he finds something fairly close to him. And then eventually he points stuff that goes way out again. And then it comes in and it goes out and it comes in. It's an interesting progression. He's walking through various inversions. And so we have awarenesses alternating inside and outside, don't you see? And we have awarenesses also varying on the dynamics. And we have awarenesses varying on the note of mystery scale. We have these things paralleled. Well, we can get an awfully good notion of what we are up to with preclear. The auditor's awareness in operating with SLP-8 is, however, invited not to some hidden point. It's invited to rather obvious things. Blindness, by the way, has its total causation in this. If you always depend on that wall to stop your sight, And then you never yourself stop your sight. Then the stopping of sight becomes an automaticity. You must always be told at what depth to stop your sight. You follow me? Then if there's nothing there to stop your sight, you become discombobulated. And you start looking for hidden influences, which is merely a search for something to stop your sight. Why can't you stop your sight? Say, why can't you make your sight rest at any given distance from you? Well, now it is a self-determined action, entirely self-determined, stopping your sight on something so that you can see it. And people get into circumstances where they themselves have not stopped their sight, but other things have stopped their sight so often that they no longer know where to stop their sight. They let other things judge it for them. Thus, diagnosis becomes difficult. One doesn't know where to stop his sight. He isn't even trying to stop his sight. He's waiting for something to leap up and stop his sight for him. And of course, the atomic physicist has gone right on down to the atom and the molecule and the electron and other probably non-existent items in an effort to get something that will stop his sight. And he becomes quite frantic, by the way. Now, the individual who speaks into nothingness, he speaks into nothingness and finds himself growing apathetic, is simply missing the usual backdrop which stops his voice. Do you see that? Now, he should be able to stop his voice. I'll give you a demonstration of this. It's actually possible to stop your voice at certain points, at certain distances from yourself. Phoenix Congress, one time I gave an example of this. It was very peculiar that the magnetic tape recording, which was made of that particular thing, followed right through with the test. When I was throwing my voice and stopping it in the back of the hall, it wasn't much going into the microphone, although I was standing in front of the microphone. The voice was quite loud in the back of the hall and missing on the tape, more or less. Just as an example, you stop your voice. Now, if you depended on the back of the room or the backdrop of the room to stop your voice always, then one day you would be called upon to speak in a room that had no back. You would find yourself very upset. Now, if you depended always upon some object to stop your sight, then someday there would be no object there to stop your sight, and you would start looking for something that would stop your sight. You aren't looking for anything but something which would arrest your vision. If you see that clearly, you will understand this whole subject of diagnosis. People become obsessed with looking for hidden influences. They try to look too deep. They look right on by. They look right on through the obvious. Now, the reason that you are interested in obnosis, observing the obvious, is because it's an exercise in you stopping your sight, and you find it quite novel. You find it quite interesting. You're stopping your sight for a change. You're deciding where your sight is going to halt. It's quite remarkable. You decide that it will halt on a wart, not on a hidden particle, which is a distant cousin of strontium 90 and is a cross between an electron and a giraffe. You see? Well, an SLP is not devoted to diagnosis beyond this point. You have to be able to observe when a comm lag is flat, when an ability is gained, or a cognition has occurred. And if you can observe those three things, you can throw in a bridge and keep going. But you have to be able to observe the obvious to know when the preclear has a somatic. A preclear always has a somatic visibly. He doesn't have to tell you he has a somatic. If you're looking at the preclear, you know he has a somatic. I can tell you when a preclear is sitting on grief, when he's sitting in fear, when he's suddenly hit apathy, when he's becoming enthusiastic and so on. Even though he's a rather deadpan preclear, he couldn't hide this. It's written across his brow, but not even as spectacularly as that. He simply is giving the manifestation of that physically. And the physiological manifestation of it may be very minute, but trained observation renders this an elementary observation. PC says, that's a real obvious one. You say, what's the matter? He says, nothing, nothing matter. Well, what'd you just hit? Nothing. I didn't hit anything. Come on. Come on. What did you just think about? Well, I guess it must be my wife. Yes, it's... What am I doing to this guy? What am I doing to this? Pestering him, bothering him, asking him what he did. I'm making him confront something and become aware of it. I'm punching him to pieces, as a matter of fact. I'm saying, come on, fella, you got a sympathetic listener? Take a look. You've got an assistant visio here. Let's take a look at this thing. He is not even aware of the fact that he is sighing most ordinarily. Now, that's an obvious manifestation. How about the manifestation of fear, which simply is registered in a tiny, tiny rigidity of shoulder? All of a sudden, his shoulder becomes just a little more rigid. You wouldn't hardly notice it at all. But there's a difference. You say, what's the matter? Well, nothing the matter. Why? Well, what'd you just think of just as you answered that question? What'd you just think of when you executed that command? Oh, nothing. I didn't think of anything, as a matter of fact. Shoulder goes more rigid. You didn't think of anything. Well, all right. What feeling went through you at that time? No feeling at all. No feeling at all, huh? Except, of course, well, a feeling like, you know, aren't we touching on awfully personal things? In other words, all I'm doing is saying, here you go, boy, confront this now. Well, I know there's something there for him to confront because he has just exhibited it, and I am a better observer than he is. That's all it amounts to. I am not unaware of what he is unaware of. Part of his inability to observe this is, of course, his unawareness of its substance. Well, we are really not asking him to look for hidden influences. The influence is just about as hidden as a neon sign in his life. This consistent grief registers and manifests itself in his abandonment of everything he undertakes. And yet he never observes that he's abandoning everything he undertakes. He just thinks life is being mean to him. If you gave him a $10 gold piece, he'd lay it down the sidewalk and walk off. And you'd say, why did you do that? Well, he said it was taken from me. See how he's been living his life. Well, he hasn't observed this point. Observing the obvious is very elementary, as a matter of fact, but it's knowing where to stop your sight. There's no sense in going on and on and on and looking deeper and deeper and deeper for the hidden influence and the menace and the invisible particle and the lost universe and all that sort of thing. Why go on looking for this? Because they're not stopping the preclear sight, usually. Now, the things that are stopping the preclear from living are written upon him. They're branded on him thoroughly. And if you treat any of them, the whole case will fall out in your hands. It's not difficult to do this. But SLP 8 does not demand such perspicuity of perception. It doesn't demand this exact observation. All it demands from you is that you start your preclear in the lower ranges, and when his calm legs are flat, when his ability is regained, when his cognitions are reached, that you throw in a calm bridge and go forward. That's all it really demands. Now, as I told Dr. Lattice the other day, he wanted to know why an SLP. I told him that an SLP was a stopgap. It was a list of things which could be performed by people who could then achieve results without imposing upon them the necessity of being very perspicuous. And it was better to have an SLP than it was to have no results at all. But the auditor observation, if he knows his stuff, the auditor observation is always better than an SLP, because you demand of an SLP that it embrace all cases. And this is a fantastic request. You could not have an SLP which would operate without an auditor. An SLP is always a servo mechanism to an auditor who knows some procedure. Therefore, an SLP is not anywhere near as vital to somebody who's been through an ACC, a good one, as it is to somebody who has not at all studied the subject close up, but just read a book or two on it. He could take an SLP and he could probably get rather fantastic results with it, you see. So an SLP does have value. And having this value, it carries Scientology a lot further. It's quite interesting that it's much easier to write an SLP, difficult as it is to write an SLP and embrace all cases with an SLP, than to try to embrace all auditors with good procedure. But it's much easier to teach an auditor in an ACC good procedure and then trust that his use of the SLPs will be modified by his power to observe. All right, there are several classes of processing, and all of these classes are included in this SLP, but confronting this, you know, only goes up to Axiom 10, and Axiom 10 processes are also included in this SLP, and then higher than that we have the creative processes. You want to be very chary of using creative processes just as such on any preclear who comes along, because they're usually entirely over his head, and all you do is scramble the bank. Do you follow me? Therefore, are these lower ranges, basic communication, subjective havingness, objective havingness, substitution, and confront, are definitely the entering wedges. And if you, in 75 hours, could carry a preclear all the way through those and just get him up within easy reach of an Axiom 10 process, you would have completely changed his life, and you very definitely would have created somebody who was way above the normal average person. You see, it's not a small goal you're reaching for just to embrace that. It's a very large one. Well, it's all right for you to become very ambitious and say we're going to reach all the way up through these, the basic communication processes, the subjective, the objective havingness processes, push it up through substitution, push it up through confronting, so on, causative methods here. And then we're just going to shoot the moon and we're going right on up through the remainder of the axioms. Well, that would be all right. It'd be perfectly all right. Unless your ambition overreaches the ability of the preclear, because after that occurs, you give him loses. And having given him loses, why, he is then less able to follow forward than he was before. You see that? So you give the preclear wins, keep him in a games condition. Life becomes eventually simple enough so that he could confront the basic truths contained between axioms 1 and 10. All right. Now, these processes, as I have them here, are not really in a final order. I would say that some of these positions are certain to be changed before the book, How to Help Individuals, is written. It's very well for me to say this is it and so on, carry forward that way, but the truth of the matter is we're not interested in my correctness or positiveness. This couldn't have less importance, actually, to me. We're interested in rounding off and squaring up and making functional a subject and a study. And you see some difference between my methods of proceeding and the methods of those around me, and methods of proceeding which have been used in earlier times on similar and related subjects. There's quite a difference. I would not stoop to the wishy-washy doubtful, I'm scared to be wrong attitude of the modern scientist. It is too degraded. It just is practically regurgitative in its reaction. Said to one of them one day, he was selling me, well, according to Professor Wimpf Wumpf, and according to that and that, well, I'm not sure, and I there, and one has to maintain a scientific objectiveness about the whole thing. And I said, you sure that you aren't maintaining a political cowardice? Took him a half an hour to understand what I was talking about. He actually, though, didn't take it as an insult. He was too low on the scale to consider it otherwise than a compliment. He thought I had at last perceived that he was being witty, and he perceived that he himself was being very smart. He thought he saw a reason for being very timid about ever declaring anything, anything. You could be wrong. You could be fired. You could be kicked out of the university chemistry laboratory, don't you see? Well, we're not in a position of being kicked out of anywhere, so we don't care whether we're right, whether we're wrong. I've been right many more times than I've been wrong. The glaring errors on the back track are not very glaring. I've led a few astray. Probably more than anything else, I led people astray who wanted to die by persuading them that through this road we would eventually survive. I led them astray. They were bound on one path, and we were bound on another one, and we dragged them along the survive track a bit far. We got them almost lost. There are some people around who can't even commit suicide now. But that's leading people astray. But where the accuracy of these predictions is concerned, they have all turned out fairly well. But the more we know about this subject, the less we feel we have to be very didactic about it. The truth of some of these propositions is so sweeping. But if you think you would have to argue anyone into accepting them, it's something like arguing somebody into accepting a 16-inch shell. He hasn't got any say about it at all. If he can observe it at all, he will eventually become aware of it. And become aware of it as a king block in his own life pattern. And he will say, well, now that's what the universe is made out of. If he can observe it all, your engagement in arguments with the uninformed is the most wasted time that anybody ever possibly could expend. Because if they don't click on what you're saying, if there isn't some little responsive spark, their degree of awareness is such that it is not probable that you will have any forward progress, no matter what the argument is, unless, of course, you backed it up with bayonets or something. And we're not in a political conquest here at all. It's a conquest of knowledge. And somebody sits in the drawing room and says, nya, nya, or a couple of high school kids that came in on Dr. Barrett here one night in the School of Life. And anything he said, why, they chopped him, see, one way or the other. They were being very wise, and they were being smart. And they walked away thinking they'd won. Yes, yes, they'd won a skull and crossbones. They actually sat here listening to Dr. Barrett, who was a very smart man. And these boys didn't know where they were going. I just give you some blunt examples. They wouldn't know how to please a girl, procure a car, you know, the elementary things. Work enough or procure some money. They sat there with more problems and more potential unhappiness, you see, than you could have bailed up in a month's Sundays. And there they sat chopping somebody. In other words, they were so unaware they didn't even know they were in trouble. They didn't even know that they were that far gone. Quite interesting. One looks with some, not sympathy certainly, but one looks with a certain degree of sadness, one might say, upon such an activity. And somebody's objection to what we're saying in Scientology is no slightest cue to me to suddenly mount my white charger and couche the lance, you know, and go down the course. No, I pat him on the head and say, poor fellow. A horrible thing to do, much more effective. Wonder when I'll be sending them flowers. what insane asylum will they be inside of as the years go by? This has become very acutely factual, by the way, in handling the modern scene here. The way it looks to me, I've been looking over some health records here. I told you I was going to get the United States Health Department records. And I got the retired director and got him on the ball. And boy, I possibly would not say too much, possibly, by saying that we can be certain that a Scientologist will survive this. We can be certain that a Scientologist will survive this. But we can't at all be certain about other people. We have, through our years of processing and work and understanding, achieved an ability and a stability towards such phenomena, which is entirely missing in all other stratas of life. And I would say, I'm sure, I just know very well, that we could get through an atom saturated Earth. You see, they can only saturate it so long, and then homo old style will no longer have the strength to push the bomb into the airplane, go drop it, you see. So there is a stopping point there. And I'm sure that we can hit that level and still live with considerable ease. When I look at these fellows now, I'm like looking at an arena full of gladiators, you know. They're quite interesting. They're going to bat hit everyone in the head, but they don't know enough to get away with it. Our main line of approach here for years has actually placed us in a superior position with regard to atomic fission and other things. I mean, just on a health level, Scientologist doesn't get as sick as other people, that's all. He has a better health level. If he does get sick, he pulls out of it faster. And so on. In other words, we have an edge. Now, this SLP's value would be mainly found in spreading that edge. And if this SLP could make it easier for more auditors, not precisely trained, to spread that edge, why, you see, there'd be more of us still alive a few years from now. So it does have that value at this time. Now, the first level of this is very fundamental. It's as low as we've got. If anybody is at all aware, then we have ways and means of making them aware of us. And if that is the case, communication can begin. Do you see that? Obvious simplicity. So there's where this SLP starts. Let's take an insane person. We would mimic the insane person until the insane person were aware of us. And then we would use mimicry processes and other processes until we had him up to where his awareness of us and his environment was better. Don't you see? Now, you know how to do that. And you've been taught rather thoroughly on that. It would be very difficult to give in writing what you've learned in this ACC. Very, very difficult. All right. Things like look at me, who am I, identification types of processes, that sort of thing, all belong in this communication level. Now, we're establishing the rudiments with communication, and we continue to establish the rudiments. And it could be said, if we continued only to establish the rudiments for the next 189 hours and a half of processing, we would win like mad. You see that? Because essentially, what is life? There is nothing wrong with the fellow except his awareness of other dynamics. His awareness of these things is withheld, unwilling, devious, too meaningful, too significant. His awareness of other dynamics is in difficulty. So that if we can get him to locate one person and one room and one self, man, what we will have achieved. So we cannot minimize, look at me, who am I? What are you doing? The old standby for the preclear who can't find out he's being audited. What are you doing right now? I have another variation of this that's one step removed and works better. What do you want to be audited for? Just as though, and ask as though, it's a personal imposition on his part with regard to me. And I make him explain himself, and I make him get reasonable about the whole thing, in that he does not realize he's in session. He comes into a cognition after a while that he is in session, but that he's been in session for some time with some other auditor, which he confuses with an auditor, such as the doctor at birth. You get the idea? Oh, what do you want to be audited for? Go on, explain yourself here. Well, you're a good auditor. You got out, Ron, you get terrific results. I mean, you know, you do things for people, all right? Well, how do you know that? Oh, I read papers. I listen to people. I read this and that. Well, have you ever seen it yourself? No. No? No, come to think about it, I haven't. But I just sort of know, you see. I just know that you could help me. Well, how could I help you? Why could I help you? What do you want to be audited for anyway? Hitting his level of argumentation and so on. Now, we take the reverse of this, quite workable on people who don't want to be audited. All they're aware of is that they don't want to be audited. They don't want to be helped. They don't want to be assisted. They don't want. They know this for sure. So I ask them to explain this. Although two-way communication chops up their headiness madly. Remember that. Always does. Nevertheless, it's better than sitting in the soup they're sitting in. Always better. Well, why don't you want to be audited? Well, my brother Bill had a tonsillectomy once, and he couldn't talk for a week. Well, what's that got to... You explain to me the similarity between a tonsillectomy and being audited. Well, the same situation. You sit in a room and so on. Well, hell, there's no difference. What are you talking about? All right. Now, you tell me why you don't want to be audited. It's quite amazing. You get into amazing, impassioned arguments with these people. You, the auditor, maintain pleasant ARC throughout. You see. You're auditing them right straight down the line. And then after a while, they find it out. And you have established at least that much of the rudiments. A session is in progress. In other words, this is another method and an undercutting of a session is in progress. You're trying to get a gradient scale here. A session is not in progress, and we gradually gradient scale it into being in progress by asking the fellow why he wants to be audited or why he doesn't want to be audited. And we eventually achieve a session in progress on this gradient scale. In other words, we don't run an unknowing session on him. That's another gag entirely. We're auditing him and he doesn't know it. I rather frown on that in spite of the fact that I have done it to U.S. senators and things. I have done it to people. I've done it to people in the British government. So on. They're not sure what it's all about. It leaves them in a spooked condition, but that was my intention. Now, good auditing is accomplished on a knowingness basis, and the individual, when he discovers that a session is in progress, is capable, then, of responding to this. He finds out he is doing something. He is engaging in a life activity, and this life activity consists of communicating with another being, and he's participating in a moment of life of such and such a date, such and such an hour, such and such a minute. You see, he is finding himself in present time. You see, he can identify present time because a session is in progress. So if you only establish these three things with these basic rudiments, you would go a long ways. But we take off from there and go into subjective havingness. We make sure that a preclear can remedy his havingness subjectively, no matter if he's a black case or a pink case, before we go any further. Why? Because it's a safety valve. It's a good thing to do. Very good thing to do. And he can't be gotten into trouble thereafter by an auditor. You see that? He can remedy havingness at the last moment when he's just about to sink out of sight. Why, somebody can still remedy his havingness. Do you see that? Whereas a black case that cannot remedy its havingness is surrounded by black screens, which screens are perpetually absorbing all the havingness he receives from anything. And anything you do with him is an uphill climb. Blackness and a black field has been solved by putting blackness into the walls. Just that, nothing more. Put blackness into the walls. Six walls round, but it's much better to do it by a subjective remedy of havingness. Mock up a black object and a black in the black field which he has there. Just mock up a black object, shove it into the body. Mock it up, shove it in. Mock it up, shove it in. Mock it up, shove it in.
walk up a black object, shut it. That's all it is. Then walk up a black object and let it remain, walk up a black object and throw it away. In some gradients, we can get him to do all three of these actions. We can then get him to get mock-ups rather easily, and he can then see his facsimiles, and he can do all sorts of interesting things. Now, there is the fellow with the blank field. He is no different from the black field. You have him mock up blank objects, invisible objects, don't you see, and shove them in and remedy havingness with them. Blows a case all over seven states. He says, I'm looking at nothing. Good. Mock up a good, solid nothing and throw it in. Subjective remedy of havingness, number two on that list. And then we get the various control processes. First is part A of 8C. Touch the object, let go of it, you know, a walkabout. And then we get tactile 8C. Look around the room and find something you wouldn't mind having or could have or something of the sort, and you walk over to it and feel it. Got it? That's a tactile 8C that combines 8C and a havingness process and is one of the most drastically effective things you ever cared to drill pretty clear through. Combines these two things. Now, the next process on this list is start CS. You don't run him very long on start or change or stop. Just dabble with it. It's the easiest thing anybody ever ran. It really is. It's just start CS. You monkey with it. You monkey with some start, and you fool around with some change, and you fool around, but not very thoroughly, with some stop, and you monkey with this and that. You just make sure that he does these things, that's all. You pat him on the back and yackle with him and so on. Don't push him. Don't crowd him, because you push somebody on change, and wow. You can get him into more confusion than he's been in many a day. This is a real beefy process. And when you run it here as step five of SLP 8, why, remember, that's just a dabble. You don't goof as an auditor. You don't goof at all. You're very precise with your controls and so on. But you are not at all didactic about how thoroughly he starts or how thoroughly he changes or how thoroughly he stops. You've got the idea? Now, you just stop when you want to. I'm going to indicate to you some point or another when I want you to stop. And then when you decide that you're going to stop, why, you stop, too. You know, and he walks on 15 paces before he can finally find out that he's going to stop. You got the idea? Very imprecise as far as what the preclear does, but extremely precise as far as what the auditor does. Now we have keep it from going away. Keep it from going away is, of course, a very easy thing. We have a routine with two non-significant objects. We run two non-significant objects, and then we run two significant objects if we want to. Two non-significant objects, we just pick them up that don't mean anything particular to the preclear. We have him put one on one arm of his chair and one on the other arm of his chair or on the table in front of him. You must have some support for these objects. And we have him now with two non-significant objects, one to the right of him, one to the left of him. He's sitting down, preclear, sitting down, and the auditor's sitting down, too. You see that? And we give these commands. Look at the, well, it's object one, whatever you call it. Pick it up. Keep him going away. Now, you keep it from going away is the insisting version, see? But look at it, pick it up, keep it from going away, and put it back exactly in the same place. Now, you have him look at the other one. You say, look at it, pick it up, keep him going away, put it back in exactly the same place. That's the simplest version of it. Now we complicate this. We say, look at it, pick it up, keep him going away, put it back in exactly the same place, and leave it entirely uncontrolled. And then we do that with the two, just repetitively and so on. It is a version of op pro by dupe. That is, it's a beast. It's a beast. Now, that is a sneaky confront. You notice we've used here nothing but havingnesses and direction and communication right up to this time. And that's a sneaky confrontingness. Now, there's a great deal of us keep it from going away. Keep them going away on the body, keep the hand from going away, and so on. It's the quickest relief for chronic somatics for most levels of case, if you can really get them to do it. Very often the case is too apathetic. and really can't do it, and will just dog on it for hours. You overshot the process rather easily. Number eight is keep it from going away by sight. In other words, not with the hands, but by sight. You've graduated into the simplicity of keeping something going away by sight. Many people would be willing to do this before they would keep it from going away with their hands. You run the hands. Now there's connectedness. Very simple. Look around and find something you wouldn't mind making connect with you. On how many vias could you make it connect? That's the auditing command. You make it connect with you. You see, now we've been running havingness and communication. This connectedness is a communication. Keep it from going away as I can continue to communicate with it, don't you see? And so on. And now we sneak upstairs into the next level. And this is a whole class of processes, and these are the confusion processes. And here we handle the rest point and the stable datum with substitutions and other means here. The basic one on this is this means go to, having the waltz talk to him. It's the most elementary and sweeping one. This means go to, this means don't go to. In other words, you're substituting places for where he isn't. Got it? It's a very complicated process, by the way. You go six times around, this means go to. Six times around, this means don't go to. When you've got that pair flat, alternating, then you say six times around, this means stay in, this means don't stay in, so on. You're getting substitute locations, substitute spots. You'll find it'll give him new rest points, and it'll do other interesting things for him. It won't run on a case that can't put a postulate in the wall. Now we have all sorts of oddities. Here in this same bracket, we have 11, confuse that wall. Lovely process. Pretty wild. You're making the wall substitute for all kinds of things all over. You just tell a fellow to confuse the wall. If he's ever painted, for instance, he's had this flat, dead canvas sitting in front of him. He's trying to make it live. You know, the sheet music, he was trying to make it alive. The person, he was trying to make it alive. So he's actually wound up in a confusion as a substitute for alive. If you want to make something alive, you confuse it. That's about where he's sitting. Confuse that wall. Number 12, a confusion which you could cause. Mock up a confusion. The lightest one is a confusion you could cause. Just tell me a confusion you could cause right now. That is the lighter one, and then mock up a confusion. This all goes into the thing. Now, you're just substituting confusions. You're giving him enough confusions to substitute for the confusions that he is sitting in, you see. And you run it by substitutes. You see, it's not necessarily true that he doesn't have enough confusions. It is only true that he is fighting back against a confusion he can't have. And you give him substitute confusions he can have, and he eventually can accept the confusion, see. Substitution processes. Now, we go up the line up here, and we get now into the bear cat of substitution, the substitute stop, this could be called, and it's called actually stop CS, run in all violence. That's the substitute stop. You're substituting this stop for other stops he stopped. He can tolerate this stop, but he couldn't tolerate the auto accident stop, so you make him stop. And you get substitute stops, and he comes all the way up. If he can run this, it's terrific. Anybody can run this, given enough a sufficiently violent auditor. So sufficiently precise. Tolerance of motion and stillness is number 14. Tolerance of motion and stillness. All kinds of oddities here can be run, such as you have them go outside and spot something that's moving, spot something standing still. A lot of preclears that are in bad shape, spot them in reverse, by the way. See an automobile go down the street and say, that's still. You're looking right straight into his case. He's on an inverted situation there. Now, funny part of it is that all of our confrontingness processes, objective or subjective confrontingness processes, run from there on up, all the confrontingness processes I've been telling you about. And then above these are the subjective confrontingness processes. Mock it up and make it confront. You see? Now, when I say confrontingness process, I don't mean a covert one like 8C Part A. I mean an overt one. You confront that wall. Find a still spot somewhere around here, and you make your body confront it. Drive that car down the road and make it confront that space. Tears out every auto accident you ever had, every accident ever. Actually, that's the way you should drive a car. You should make it confront that road. It shouldn't be making you confront anything. And we get all of these confrontingnesses, and they go up then into the creative levels of processes, which we have not much taken up in this ACC, but which we have taken up bounteously in other ACCs. We're over the head of a lot of PCs. Now, these areas of confrontingness, all these confronting processes, as I say, they're objective and then subjective, but no precise number is assigned to any of these because some people can do them subjective before they can do them objective and vice versa. Now, over and under, confront that bank, as all that process should be called. It really is confront that bank. We just run all variations of that. Then we move upstairs and we get to the not-know processes, well up not-know processes, and above the not-know processes, why we have straight creation, just straight creation. The auditing command of that is create a universe, move in. Thank you very much.